Wednesday, October 6th, began early. When Jack, in Lennon's bedroom, sometime after 7:30, said, "I must go see a showing of this film at the State Department, the one we're preparing for the salute to Congress." Lennon said, "Let's go with him. You get ready in 5 minutes?" In my gown with an unwashed face, I said, "It will take me 10. And sure enough, in 10 minutes, we dashed out the door, raced to the State Department, walking in about 8:15 with the early shift, and saw the 3-screen documentary put together by HEW of the achievements of the 89th Congress. It was moving and beautiful, I thought, but showed the haste with which it had been put together, and needed a thrilling, big-name narrator. On the way back, Gregory Peck was on the row in front of us, and he had been signed up to do the narrating in the next few hours. The whole thing to be shown tonight or Thursday night. Logistically, it would be a terrifically hard thing to do, and to my surprise, Lyndon and Jack did not agree with me that it was good. Actually, I was relieved, because added to the 50-minute show we already had with the salute to Congress, it would be too much entertainment, too hard to mesh. The screens, the lights, the props. And then, next, there was a signing in the East Room at 10 o'clock of the $340 million bill providing grants to medical centers fighting heart disease, cancer, and stroke. Lyndon had referred to it as setting up a bunch of little mayos around over the country so Dale Malachek and Alvin Sultemeyer can get to them. This was one I wanted to see, one of those I'm proudest of. Lyndon and I walked in, with everybody seated, and I took my seat on the front row, along with John Gardner of HEW, and Lister Hill, the father of all the medical legislation in the Senate, the Surgeon General, and behind us, Mary Lasker and Florence Mahoney. It was a beautiful tribute, Lyndon's speech was, to the men who are occupied in the restoration of health to other men. He never once mentioned his own problem, making it all the more dramatic. But he threw in an impromptu accolade to Lister and to Mary Lasker. And then he gave out pens, and I gathered up Mary and her guest, Mrs. Patenaugh, France, and Florence Mahoney, and we went upstairs for a quick cup of coffee, planned for Mary and Nash and I to drive around over the city at 2 o'clock to look at several entrances to Washington, with the possibility of making one of them a pilot project in beautifying an entrance with cash on hand in the Society for More Beautiful Capital. Meanwhile, we'd have Madame Patenaugh take a tour of the White House. Lyndon was having a whirlwind of a day. After the signing, a walk around the White House grounds, with the dog, shaking hands with tourists, taping a speech, seeing a delegation from Appalachia, popping in at the National Press Club luncheon for cartoonists, consultations with his economic and fiscal advisors, as though to show the world how tough, how well, how indestructible he was on the eve of going to the hospital. I worked at my desk until 2. And then Mary and Nash and I drove for a couple of hours around the approaches to the 14th Street Bridge, one of the main entrances from the National Airport, and also from the south and west, and then the entrance on the Southwest Freeway down close to the Capitol, which is pictured in Mary's booklet, right off of Main Avenue, I believe it is, between 7th and 9th. And it proved so hard to approach from the angle that we wanted to approach it. But after about 40 minutes driving, I felt like Lyndon's story about the drunk giving directions to how to get to the post office, which ended, "You can't get there from here." The National Park Service has a reasonably good budget, and the District of Columbia is something of a stepchild. Little money, little aggressiveness, and not the zeal of the Park Service. So it behooves us to spend our money, I suppose, on ground that belongs to this District of Columbia, and try to win all the cooperation we can get between D.C., the National Park Service, and the state of Virginia, since those three between them command the entrances to the capital city. We did not find the perfect spot. We found some good prospects. We did not have time to go out New York Avenue, the major entrance from the north and east, and the shabbiest of all. But that awaits another time, and Mary flew off to Washington, and I flew back to the White House, just in time to dress for the 5 o'clock reception for the new members of Congress, that is, the Democratic freshmen, who were so largely responsible, the 70 or so of them, for the fabulous success of Lyndon's program in this Congress. Once more, we were seated in the East Room. It takes on more and more the aspect of a seminar in an unusual university. Lyndon welcomed and praised and thanked. And then Larry O'Brien took over with charts that showed the 70 or so bills that went into the hopper at the beginning, the progress in June, the status now, how many passed, are awaiting some committee action, and how many yet to come up on the floor. Only 4, I believe. Then, in the blue room, we all had our pictures made again. The only reason I approve of doing it twice is my own keen regret that I never got any at all of us together with FDR in the 8 years we served under him. Our 3 Texans were there, the Earl Cabells, the attractive Kika de la Garzas, the young Richard Whites, and Hale Boggs for the leadership, and the Speaker alone. Several of the congressmen had very nice things to say to me about the highway improvement bill. I believe Representative Dial and Farnsley of Kentucky and Roy McVicker. We went into the state dining room for drinks and buffet, and for one of the few times in my White House tenure, I did not linger at a party. I had a quick drink, a word or two with 3 or 4 couples, and then at 6:10, saying goodbye to nobody, I went upstairs, asking Lyndon to follow me later. But not until he had spent all the time he wanted to with these guests so important to whatever success he achieves. Upstairs, it was quite a different party, one I had looked forward to for oddly sentimental reasons. It was the acceptance of the Jacob Epstein bust, Churchill, which is being presented to the White House by his wartime friends. Actually, it was Averill Harriman's idea. I have become very fond of him, partly because he's indestructible, handsome at 70 or so, works hard in his country's service, and remembers his old friends. Witness the monument to FDR, and now this bust of Churchill. But the other donors are former ambassadors to Great Britain. Not all were present, the Winthrop Aldriches were not. But David Bruce was, and wartime comrade-at-arms such as Carl Spatz and General Frederick Anderson, the latter had flown all the way from Europe just for this hour. And General Eisenhower couldn't be here, but had sent a sweet note. And Ira Aker, who was here. A very noteworthy guest was youthful, pink-cheeked Winston Churchill and his pretty wife. He's the grandson of Sir Winston Churchill, and he's touring the United States making lectures about his travels over Africa in a single-engine plane. It was an evening of nostalgia. Anna Roosevelt and her husband, Dr. James Halsted, were there, and also the Franklin D. Roosevelt Juniors, and Bill White and Eddie Folliard. No greater admirer of Winston Churchill than Bill White, who'd been in England as a war correspondent before and after D-Day, and the widow of Edward R. Murrow, and the British ambassador and Lady Dean, and Kay Halley, who had been very instrumental in getting legislation introduced to make Sir Winston an honorary citizen of the United States. We had a little ceremony, some graceful words by Averill Harriman, and then by Lyndon, moving through his fast-paced day, and finished with his freshman congressman and joined us about 2 minutes before. And a response by the Patrick Dean. And then I felt moved to express myself. Usually I am dragged by duty or shoved by Liz, but this time I wanted to talk, and I felt that I did it well. In fact, I was quite elated, and only later heard from Lyndon that he could only understand about half of what I said. But since lots of people told me it was very good, I decided he really was hard of hearing. But one of the nicest moments was a thoughtful suggestion of Averill Harriman that we ask young Winston Churchill to say a few words. And if the words didn't exactly dazzle, the name did. He's a healthy, charming, ruddy-faced youngster, and I listen for what happens to him. It was, in all, a very pleasant hour and a half, much of which I spent telling Averill Harriman just a very few of the nice things I think about him, and being sorry that his 90-year-old cousin, Daisy Harriman, hadn't been able to accept. She'd written a nice note, she just didn't feel up to coming, and trying to get to know the British ambassador and Lady Dean a little better. And telling Diana Hopkins Baxter, daughter of Harry Hopkins, about a picture of her, age 7, with her father and President FDR, that had hung on Lyndon's walls all the years that he was in the House of Representatives. And David Bruce, our ambassador to Great Britain, how enchanted Lindbergh was with his wife, Evangeline, when she had called on us. Everyone left early. Lyndon vanished back to his office, and I realized that this long, full day that in the morning had seemed so endless lay now quite placidly before me. I had a little time with Lucy, who sometimes behaves like a free psychiatrist. In describing me, she said, "You stand up there like you are heroine number one. Nothing can hurt you. You do not need his help." She was speaking of Lyndon.
Yep.
She also thinks I act like I do not need anyone's help. If he has left you out of any part of his life, it is your own fault. One thing about Lucy, she's very sure of her verdicts. She is delightful, opinionated, sometimes uncomfortably intuitive, and a joy to have for a daughter. I called Jim Kane and Willis Hurst, and they came down, and we were ready for a quiet dinner, which Lyndon came tamely enough at 8 o'clock, much to my joy. Jim said the blessing. It was wholesome, happy company, enlivened by Lucy's presence part of the time, and the volley of teasing she and her daddy ducked, and then, by 10 o'clock, we were in bed. Even the night reading did not detain Lyndon much beyond 11.